Hello, my lovelies, and welcome back to another episode of Confessions of a PYP Teacher. I'm Lou Gerlach with Think Chat, and welcome, my friends, to a new book study. And for some of you, you're going to say, what? We're exploring another book? There's so many topics to be discussed, and I totally agree with you. And I have wrestled with what I was going to talk about after the PYP Classroom Success Criteria, because I wanted it to be meaningful for you and for me, but I kept circling back to culturally responsive teaching and the brain, promoting authentic engagement and rigor among culturally and linguistically diverse students by Zarina Hammond. This book has changed me in the past year, and I've wanted to express it for so long. And I just couldn't wait any longer. I had to go back in. And as my friend Trish says, I wanted to stick my foot in it. I wanted to get back into the work and really unpack what do these things mean and how do they apply to our practice. Because this book and the insights from this book, oh gosh. So really left an imprint on my heart, and it's going to be filled this journey with insights from Zaretta and her book, my thoughts and my meanderings as I go along. If you've been listening at all, you know that I tend to get off track a bit, but I believe that these are the times that I make the most ahas for myself, and I hope you do as well. So let me start off by saying, Zaretta Hammond is the first person in a very long time that has made me excited, made me weep, and find hope in a short span of time. This book made me excited to see all of the possibilities that are available to learners from diverse backgrounds, from diverse identities, abilities, neurodivergence. And we're going to focus on building rigor instead of watering down the curriculum. And she made me weep, my friends, because I think of all the learners I wasn't able to reach during my teaching career because I didn't have this book. And I remember when I finished it about 10 months ago, I told my friend Vidya, I said, why didn't I have this in my first year of teaching? Because, Zaretta and I have been teaching roughly around the same amount of years, her a little bit more now. But, we need that many years of practice to be able to synthesize and put these ideas together. But she also made me have hope in this book. And I hope that more people read this book. It's taken some traction since the Total Ties conference in our, frame of reference as educators. And what I hope for is that we have less students falling through the cracks of the educational system because of this book, and ideas that this book really brings out. So I choose to be hopeful. I'm always a hopeful person. I might go through the muck. I might worry a bit, but I always end up with hope. And in the foreword of this book, I've never been so compelled by a foreword of a book before, because it was written by Dr. Yvette Jackson. Man, is that woman. I want to know more about her too. She makes a harrowing statement that has stayed with me for nearly a year. She purports, if all brains are wired for expansive learning, high intellectual performances, and self-determination, then students of color should be experiencing this state of being. Since neuroscience has proven the variety of the premise of this syllogism, this is the time for a seminal question to be reckoned with. Why are so many students of color underachieving? I wish I was that smart to put those words together like that. But it really does make you stop to think in layman's terms. If all of us are born with the same capability to think, to connect, to apply, why is it historically that some students, right, underachieve versus others? It has to be something else than what they're born with, right? And of course, we have neurodivergency. That's how we, look at how people think differently. Of course, there's that, but that's not every child. And so, why is it that there's this chasm? And it just has really stopped me in my tracks, because I think about it, why is it that historically certain communities have not performed versus other? And there has to be certain systems in place for that to be continuously repeating. And Zaretta speaks out about being able to get access to different types of education from her own experience. That when she was growing up in the San Francisco area, she was able to access a different type of education than her peers in her neighborhood because her family used her grandparents' address, which basically had a better school system. So she had to go for an hour on public transport to get to school every day. And when there was restructure in her neighborhood, allowing access later on in her upper elementary experience, she noticed the chasm of a gap between her friends within her neighborhood to herself. And that was a big aha of why does she know more? Why were there so many dynamic learning experiences compared to her peers? And that's a big aha to have as an upper elementary primary student. And I'm sure that that just stayed with her and festered with her and sparked her curiosity as an educator, right? Of how do I rectify this situation that's so been so formative in my lens of the world? And thinking about that, having for myself, applying it myself, I grew up about an hour away from Zaretta. And I know what that political and economic divide is in that region. And it's amazing because I saw it in my own little hometown at the time when I was growing up. It was pretty podunk compared to what it is now. But what's really amazing is how one action allowed Zaretta to be granted a quality education while others were not afforded the same opportunity. And the question that springs to my mind is a country as wealthy as the United States, how is this still happening in our current day? And then, as we unravel some layers, the next question I want to ask is who benefits from the inequity of education? Oh, and now that opens a whole Pandora's box. And I don't know if you, where you live, have that same divide, but it's fascinating to me about that because we've evolved, so we say. And so in chapter one, Zaretta speaks about the reoccurring achievement gap in most American schools, and she calls it an epidemic of dependent learners unprepared to do higher order thinking, creative problem solving, and analytical reading and writing. An epidemic, right? And since we just lived through a pandemic, we know what a widespread issue is. And as a full-time trainer, I'm gonna be honest, in IB schools, in inquiry-driven schools, I see this all the time. that there's many well-meaning teachers who are working diligently to make school meaningful for their learners. But because of the constraints of their system, they might still be teaching to a test that happens at the end of the year or to meet parent expectations. And I just call this checklist teaching, to be honest. They look at the content standards they're teaching and they go, check. Okay, well, I've completed what I said I was going to do. It's done. Now we're moving on to the next thing. And that type of teaching, and it is what's causing this epidemic of unprepared students who cannot do higher order thinking, creative problem solving, and analytical reading and writing. Because we're looking at content standards or expectations that we're trying to cover within a given period of time and check off when they've been taught, because oftentimes that's how we're trained. And once again, I say this with love, because many of these teachers are working there to the bone to make this happen. Their heart's in the right place. And one thing I try to do is look at these content or process standards, how we're doing things, as tools to build learner independence. And I train teachers to look at learning from a progression from a gradual release of responsibility. And what do we mean that by that? Well, we go from more teacher-driven practice to more learner-driven. Now, is it always going to be learner-driven? No. But there's got to be a fluidity of where we go from teacher-driven, modeled, guided, to learner-driven. And this isn't new, and I didn't come up with it. Many people have used this model to discuss, for instance, inquiry. Kath Murdoch uses this type of model of gradual release responsibility in her inquiry cycle. So does Guy Claxton in his Learning River, where he talks about the different ways in which knowledge is disseminated. We know Trevor McKenzie also utilizes it in his swimming metaphor of the different types of teachers and learning situations in the swimming pool and dive into inquiry. And then, of course, we've also seen it in regards to assessment, where we've seen Sylvia Rosenthal Tolisano and Janet A. Hale talk about it in their book, A Guide to Documenting Learning, and looking at the progression of how do we document learning that speaks to the whole child, right? And so thinking about that, Zaretta considers the difference between communities in relation to access to learning skills for life. And she states that classroom studies document the fact that underserved English learners, poor students, and students of color routinely receive less instruction in higher order skills development than other students. Their curriculum is less challenging and more repetitive. And it really made me reflect on my own experience as a teacher and which schools were routinely less challenging, let's say, or more repetitive. And I've worked at them. And these were schools that were so worried about the outcomes, right? Appeasing parents or scoring big on the test at the end of the year or whatever it was that they had an objective at the end of the year, whether it's public, state, independent, or international schools, there's always some sort of thing that hangs over, right, as a pressure. And this pressure puts a lot of pressure on teachers to prepare for this either end of year exam. You know, I've seen many a teacher where they're teaching inquiry-driven practice, they're following the PYP, and then bam, winter break is over, January comes, and now it's testing mode. And how is that modeling how we scaffold the process of learning? And they go through and revert back to rote reading and math exercises. And teaching becomes then a process. A reading passage put on an overhead projector or an Elmo, learners parroting what the teacher has stated, and they're repeating the process with a new question and creating an exit ticket. To me, this is not learning. This is choral reading. Just repeating back what the teacher wants to hear. But it's no tra there's no transfer. There's no meaning making there. And as learners, we thrive when we put those moments, when we're just shoved into those moments of productive struggle, where we've been taught the skills and we're put into a moment where we have to figure out how are we going to use those skills, either by myself or with others, right? And put them to the test. Because this process allows learners to apply their thinking to relevant and significant issues that they are currently facing or others are facing in the world, so they can transfer it again into the future. And I keep telling people, this is why, as I've been a fourth and fifth grade teacher many a year, when you become a fifth grade teacher and you get kids who look at you like you have two heads when you mention the difference between a denominator and a numerator of a fraction. And we know they've learned it in fourth grade, but they had no conceptualization, no application besides eating a chocolate bar and a pizza to why do fractions matter in our real world, right? And once we do that, that's when it sticks. And so thinking about that, are we actively putting our students into a productive struggle moment regularly? And Zaretta talks about productive struggle, of that's how we learn, that's how we connect. And this is where the critical thinking she talks about, right? And the higher order thinking, this is where it comes in. And one common comment I hear from people who live outside of the United States is that testing is only an American thing. And I beg to differ because there are many cultures who might not take a final exam at each grade level, but there are exams along the way that determine the track of education that a child will be eligible for in the future. So when I was teaching in Germany, for instance, love Germany, and this is no reflection of the German system, but by fourth grade, the teacher in, collaboration with the parents sometimes, they're recommending what track of middle school the students go to. And depending on whatever track determines if they go to university, if they go to some sort of college, or if they go to trade school. By the time they're in fifth grade, they're already in that track. And what's really fascinating with that is that's the same thing, the pressure to perform so that you're placed in the right track. And of course, parents can, basically advocate for their child. But, that's a big pressure. I mean, we had to, like, I had a teaching partner and we had many discussions about children of where they should be. And it was very hard because you're thinking about the child's future. And there's other countries where, a student is in high testing pressure in secondary school, especially like in ninth grade. I remember watching a documentary about this testing pressure in Japan where students were waking up at the crack of dawn and getting tutoring after school and all this stuff to take an exam to see if they got into university. And if they didn't get the marks or didn't pass, it was a huge loss of face for the family and the community. Almost shame, right? And so thinking about all those pressures, that's what she's talking about. And this pressure around performance creates a huge anxiety in learners, especially those missing those fundamental skills to keep up with the level of rigor of the curriculum. And this creates a dependence on so many systems. And Zaretta mentions something that's really prevalent in the United States, which is called the school to prison pipeline. that she talks about without adequate skill development, many children of color are pushed out of school because they cannot keep up with the academic rigor because of their poor reading skills, their lack of social and emotional support to deal with increasing frustration. And we see behavior, oh, that kid's acting out. It's because that kid doesn't know what to do, right? And they don't have the skills to cope, and so they act out. And I think we'd all be in that same place, right? And if you want to learn more about that, go and read her book on page 13. All of these ideas have made me think about what we're doing as educators to aid or block learner agency from happening. This beginning portion of the book is quite heavy, I know, because this is a deep-rooted, systematic problem in my country and many others. We have a strong divide of who is properly educated and who is not. And as an IB educator, I firmly believe that every child, no matter what your background is, deserves the same access to education. I have believed that since the first year I've taught, before I became the label of an IB educator. Yet I've always, felt like, I've had to assess myself. Have I always provided them tools to be independent? And honestly, I have not, because they didn't know what I didn't know. And I can't beat myself up. And to be honest, that's why I said I hoped I had read this book at the beginning of my teaching journey. But I have it now. And I hope that the rest of this journey and this book study will help both of us to awaken our understanding of what it means to be a culturally responsive educator and what we can do differently. And for now, I just want you to take a moment and reflect. What have been some of your aha moments, your connections that you've explored and thought about as we've unraveled this first portion of this magical book? And if you could tell Zaretta one thing, what would it be? In the meantime, if you have time, check out Zaretta's keynote address at the Tottle Ties. It's the Inquiry Educator Summit 2023. In the bio of the podcast, I will put the link to the conference so that you can register and see the keynote. Wow, is all I gotta say. So I can't wait to uncover this hidden gems in this book and see at how it impacts my practice and yours. And of course, I'd love your feedback because we're in this work together. And I'm always hesitant to talk about other teachers and things that I observe. And I hope no one took offense of what I said today. But we're all in this together. I didn't know what I was doing for a very long time. And I still bumble, and I still make mistakes. And isn't it beautiful to admit that and say, well, at least tomorrow I'm going to be better than what I was yesterday. And that's all we can do, my friends. So until next time, have a wonderful day, and we'll talk soon, my lovelies. Bye.